Hey, this is Scriptlock, where we discuss storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Jerry Bellick and Mitu Kandaker Kakoris.
Yay.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Jerry is a game designer and developer of such games as RoboMama's Cooking Kitchen, Mystery Phone, Discourse, The Choose-a-tron, and Afterglow. And he is also the owner of a haunted NES. Mitu holds a PhD on the aesthetics of interactivity in video games, is the creator of the game Red Shirt, was named one of BAFTA's Breakthrough Brits in 2013, and is currently the assistant arts professor at the NYU Game Center. Thank you, both of you, for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. This is good company.
So we wanted to start out by just asking how both of you got into the industry. And me too, could you go first?
Oh, yeah, okay. So I feel like nobody has a straightforward answer for that. I feel like everyone starts off by saying, well, I had a totally unconventional path into the industry, and I did. So, no, I mean, I guess it wasn't that unconventional, but I basically, so I always knew that I wanted to basically work in video games. Either that or be an astronaut. Those were the two totally realistic career options I had laid out before me, which is why I went to college to do computer engineering, because I was like, you know, I could totally hedge my bets if I just do, you know, general engineering. I can go in either direction. And then basically I was offered the chance to do a PhD in video game stuff at the university that I was at in Portsmouth in the UK. And yeah, so basically while I was, you know, and I started doing this PhD, looking at sort of novel control mechanisms in games, and then while I was partway through it, I left for a little bit to work on a startup, which was sort of, you know, this was around the time when sort of Foursquare and Gowalla and all those like location-based services were really big. And I was like working on this, I was working on this location-based game. And then, you know, there was this whole saga with, you know, I sort of got to experience a little bit of the sort of extreme Silicon Valley sort of startup model, shall we say, and the sort of ethos that goes around that. And, you know, and this thing that I was working on kind of got shaped into this, you know, this sort of really, I was trying to avoid saying gross, but it turned into this gross sort of social media thing, which I didn't entirely agree with. And I basically left and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to work on video games by myself in a room with no other people. So I started The Tiniest Shark, and I was lucky enough to find Positech Games, run by Cliff Harris, of course, who's worked on the sort of democracy games and gratuitous space battles, etc. And he was really interested in publishing Redshirt, which was this idea of I had for this sort of social networking simulator, very much informed by aforementioned Silicon Valley experiences, I suppose, the sort of extreme end of what our sort of dystopian social networking future could look like.
Interest in becoming an astronaut.
Yes, and my interest in becoming an astronaut. All these threads of life experience came together in Redshirt. So yeah, I basically worked on that. It was released back in 2013 now. And yeah, so the rest is history.
Awesome. We'll get into more details about all that in a bit, but Jerry, how did you get in?
Well, I had been doing programming development work for quite a few years, most of my 20s, and mixed in there, I would get involved with theater and installations, interactive stuff, and I always found that stuff particularly fun to do, especially just building out a real space into something different and immersive. And so the last full-time job I had is working for an agency and running their mobile development team, but we'd also get these other weird jobs that would come along that involved doing installations. One of them was for the Cosmopolitan Casino in Las Vegas, this really, really, really huge thing that was being built, and then I guess was a huge debacle because the person building it couldn't afford to finish it. And so all this money was being put into it by a bank to complete it. And so we were tasked with creating a system that could distribute media across these 8 different columns that were all just like edge-to-edge high-definition monitors. So it was 384 of these monitors, and there needed to be a system that was organizing the simulations running across them so they could be all synchronized. The creative team that was working on that with us was based in New York. I'm in Minneapolis. And they were talking about some of the prototyping stuff that they were doing, including using things like Arduino, which is a development board for a microcontroller. And I'd expressed interest in that because I'd never worked with electronics before. And so they just mailed me one. And so I had this Arduino sitting in my desk, and I went to sites like Adafruit and SparkFun, which are just basically repositories of a lot of the more interesting parts that are created all over the world, but sold in a way that a consumer can actually get a hold of them without buying thousands of them. So I essentially just went through alphabetically, like just every part, because I didn't know what was possible. I didn't know what was available with sensors and all these amazing components. And I ran across a thermal printer, and I ran across a coin acceptor, and those two things just kind of collided in my head, and I wanted to make a Choose Your Own Adventure arcade machine, which was kind of my first project starting to go into the storytelling game world. So I built one over the course of a month and just kind of stuck in a cardboard box, started doing local events with friends that did a lot of literary stuff, and got convinced to do a Kickstarter, and that went really well, and started basically pursuing hardware-based, hardware and electronics-based games. And that's just kind of snowballed from there. The only other kind of foray into games I had was during high school with a few others. I'd worked on a series of games called Pack Guy, which were actually sold quite a bit for a while. And that's a big black hole of a story, but it needless to say, I got out by college and didn't go back to games until the Choose-a-tron. So that's kind of where I'm at.
That's a crazy story.
There's so many things I have to skip to make it quick, because it gets weirder and weirder the deeper you go.
We're going to get into all that in a bit. I want to go back to Me Too, and we're going to talk about social simulations a fair amount in this podcast.
Okay.
So I want to ask Me Too, first off, why is social simulation valuable?
I mean, I have always just found the idea of I guess simulating little computer people really fascinating, and I've always just felt it's a really underexplored sort of area of games. As to sort of why, I don't know. I guess it sort of helps us move towards understanding some aspect of human experience, and as to why it's valuable. I mean, I think it's valuable to design games with social simulation in it for a variety of reasons, including that I think that, you know, if we think of games as sort of these tiny models of the world, you know, when we play a game, we're sort of comparing our internal model of something with the model that's represented in a game. And one model that we all have, that we all carry around with us, is that of our sort of social interactions, like the social world in which we live. So I feel like it's sort of this sort of aspect of experience that everybody in the world can kind of relate to. And I feel like sort of modeling social simulations in your game just sort of open it up and make it more accessible. It creates this accessible vector into games. So I think that's, you know, there's many reasons why it's valuable, but I think that's perhaps one of the, you know, one of the main ones.
Do you think the industry would agree with you?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, obviously social simulations has been, you know, a vastly underexplored area of games, you know, for a number of reasons, one of which is that it's hard. Like, it's hard to distill pieces of human experience down into, you know, down into a computer model, down into numbers and down into systems. And, you know, it's so much easier to simulate collisions, basically, to simulate an object hitting another object. And that's, you know, and because of that, you can clearly see the evolutionary path that games have taken and the reason for it. But yeah, you know, I think undertaking social simulation. It's sort of, I guess it's a more sort of difficult area because, you know, you're always going to be reductive about the human experience. If you're trying to model what friendship looks like or what love looks like or what, you know, what any of these things look like, you're never going to be able to capture the entirety of what that means. So you have to be sort of necessarily reductive about it. And I think, you know, and I guess social simulation in a way is sort of inherently sort of more political in a way than sort of, you know, just simulating sort of the physics, the physical properties of the world, right? So I think, you know, because of all these reasons, it's, I suppose that's sort of going away from your initial question, but, you know, it just goes to show what's a difficult area, right?
Yeah. Like, in related to that difficulty, you gave a GDC talk last year about designing games for social simulation, and we'll link to it in our show notes. But one of the things you said there was the ability to interact with believable characters isn't strictly an AI challenge.
Right.
It's a design discipline with lots of different facets to it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Could you elaborate on that? Like,
yeah,
why
sure.
Is it an AI challenge?
Yeah, I mean, so as I was saying, you know, it's obviously difficult to model human experience in that way, but you know, and yeah, it's not strictly a tech challenge. It's not about trying to solve the problems of hard AI necessarily. It's about taking, you know, it's about thinking about what aspect of human relationships you want to model, right? Like in Redshirt, for example, it was because it's a, you know, Redshirt was kind of easier in a way because it was a game about people reducing, you know, people being reductive about their relationships with other people. And so in a way, it was kind of an easier game to make in terms of social simulation. But I think that, so basically we can think of it as a design challenge because, you know, you're making these decisions, like what do you put out and what do you leave in? And in a way, the thing I always say is the bits that you decide to omit from your model of like what love looks like, for example, actually says more than the things you choose to leave in. So I think, you know, it's not about trying to solve the challenges of hard AI. It's about, you know, and even from sort of, you know, when we look at like Eliza, the first chatbot, right? A lot of the listeners might have heard of something called the Eliza effect, which is which was this effect observed by Weizenbaum, who wrote Eliza, and basically, you know, just was really sort of taken aback by the fact that people were ascribing more sentience to this chatbot who was just kind of basically repeating things back to them. It's that sort of, you know, that model of therapy where the therapist just sort of says the thing you said back to you. These people who were interacting with it were ascribing more sentience, more personality to Eliza that she didn't actually have, because people have this tendency to kind of fill in the gaps themselves anyway. And I think that's this just interesting thing that we do as humans. We sort of have this innate desire to personify things in the world around us. And yeah, so it's about using that effect to the sort of greatest extent that we can.
I could definitely see how, like, a lot of game designers and people would approaching their work with the best of intentions of tackling something like this, but oftentimes, since it's probably not the primary component of the game or the experience they're making, it becomes quickly overwhelming and they kind of, you know, reduce it out of the game or to something that
right,
is almost
absolutely
unrecognizable. Yeah.
I have a weird question for both of you that I just thought of it. I'm not sure if it actually makes sense. Do you think we'll have a point where we'll have like social simulation engines, third-party engines like Unreal or whatever, that people just plug into their games and use that and build off those?
I'm going to say yes, because actually I'm involved in a, I'm also involved in a startup which is kind of doing that.
That totally was not a plant. I did not know that.
I mean,
awesome.
Yes. I'll be talking more about it over the next few months. But yeah, so that's a problem that I'm also working on.
I would have said yes, even without knowing.
Okay, we'll have to have you back on the podcast to talk about this when you can, then.
Okay.
That sounds fantastic.
Jerry, I'm going to ask you a question in a sec, but I want one follow-up question for me, too. You mentioned the people willing to personify Eliza.
Yeah.
Do you think that only works when there's, like, they're not talking to a physical robot person because they don't have, like, I don't know if there's a real sense of uncanny valley you can get from...
Right. Yeah,
like
you know...
That.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that, I suppose, you know, stuff, if you're talking to like a visual representation, so the question of sort of hitting the uncanny valley, the usual problems of the uncanny valley might come into effect. But yeah, you know, it's that old, that often cited page that everyone always talks about, you know, from Understanding Comics, about filling in sort of, you know, expressions, and, you know, the more abstract something is, the more room you have to fill it in with your own understanding. And I think that absolutely applies to some extent. Yeah.
Okay, Jerry. So both of you have similar views about player choice and how it's important to both of you, but Jerry, especially like with the Choosetron, why is player choice so important to you?
I think it creates this relationship between like the author and the reader, and or the game designer and the player. It gives a sense of agency to the player, and that interplay, I love the back and forth of that, of how the audience of what somebody's creating influences the creator, and how they have to change the way they think about the choices that they're providing and the ways that they're molding the space where somebody can inhabit it. And kind of like what Mito was saying, is the designing not only what narrative and what elements are visible or available, but also designing those spaces and the negative space that people can kind of fill with themselves and fill with their own imagination and own ideas. So I think giving people that choice and allowing them to invest themselves and can then create an environment that's very, very immersive. And what I've loved about working with interactive fiction and this kind of very raw level of storytelling is very much that, like, allowing a lot of room for somebody to put themselves into those stories and feel connected to something in ways that are hard to do once you start layering a lot of other things on top of that and kind of take away some of that space.
It sounds like we have a very... Oh, sorry. I was just... my first instance of butting in inappropriately. I was just going to say, it sounds like, you know, we have a very similar take on sort of what games can be for, I suppose, you know,
because
I've always advocated for games as being the sort of these like engines of like interrogation, right? Like of interrogating our own beliefs and our own model of the world as a player, but also, you know, as a designer, you also have to interrogate the way that you see things in the process of designing games. So and I think, you know, as Jerry's saying, I think, you know, allowing that room for the player to fill in the gaps. I think, you know, there's the quote for there's the always cited Sid Meier quote about games being a series of interesting choices, right? I think games are actually a series of interesting gaps is an interesting way to look at them.
No, that's a great way to put it.
It's interesting that I think people now are more talking about how they like games that feel like a dialogue between them and the designer, even if that's not what they are. That's not the way they think of it in their mind, but that's what it really is. And The Witness has just come out, and one of my friends, I saw she wasn't really enjoying it that much because she felt that it was more of a one-way dialogue and like no impetus or reason for her to put herself into the game. It was more just her just taking everything in, and she felt kind of left cold by that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've only played very little of The Witness myself so far. But I think, you know, I've completed like, you know, the first 30, like 25 to 30 puzzles. But it's very much that particular model of game where it's just like incredibly, I suppose, commanding, right? It reminds me of, there was this little browser-based game years ago. What was it called? Where it was basically about how games are this sort of almost like this abusive relationship, right, between the designer and the player. I wish I could remember what it's called, because it was incredibly, incredibly provocative and surprising but very true, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, I think that does fit the Witness rather well, actually, because I've been playing just a little bit today and yesterday, and I do have that very strong sense of like this intelligence being behind the game, that game creator watching you but being like really irritatingly silent, and in that way being kind of abusive, where you're picking around and in some points, like some of the design revealing itself to how you're being manipulated.
And it's not like this is a bad thing to do or to
make
a game less like this. It's just, it's interesting to think about in those terms. And are there any games that either of you like really like where it's those types of situations where it's just you trying to like decipher something that's presented to you and not trying, it's not asking you anything? Or you're not like putting yourself into it. It's more just the one-way dialogue again.
I'm just trying to think off the top of my head of what like one particular game to point to. Come back to me. I'll think of some good examples.
Jerry, do you have any ideas?
I guess an obvious one is something like Myst, where I remember playing it when I was young and how abusive the puzzles felt, because it didn't feel like, and I think this is one thing Witness does a better job of, but even with the puzzles, it didn't feel like they were trying to kind of like teach you the necessary components to solve things. It was purely like all of these completely independent, frustrating pieces that had all been put together like a puzzle that was just forced. All the pieces are from different puzzles and they're just like, nope, this is the picture. This is what it's going to be. And so being unable to pick up a thread of why it is the way it is, and it had its, you know, its sort of story of picking up these pages and putting it in this book, and then even there at the end, it's just like, ha, 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 you went through all of that just to doom yourself. Like it was just so mean. every part of it, from like just puzzles that wouldn't give you any clues or teach you about what. Because you didn't get that satisfaction. A lot of times you'd solve it and it felt like you just happened to put in the right solution, just brute forcing it. So you'd get it, but you wouldn't get any satisfaction. You win the game, but it takes away the satisfaction of winning because you lose.
I do wonder whether, sort of, is that something that we can apply to all puzzle games? Like, are all puzzle games abusive in some way?
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, I mean, are there any non-abusive puzzle games that we can think of?
Well, so with the, if you take the Witness though, like in some of the puzzles I observed, like there was one with a tree or with a series of trees, and you have to, you know, figure out the correct path of branches to trace. So the first one I did, I just brute forced it, and then I got it, and then I went to the next one and I got that one wrong, and then it set me back where I had to redo the previous one. I could still see the solution, but I still had to retrace it, which I thought was interesting. But then when I walked back to the first podium, I could see this hanging red apple. And that, you know, then I wandered over to that, and then I, you know, observed where the apple was, and then I was like, oh, okay. So it and with some of the other ones, it very carefully kind of has you play very simplified versions of different puzzles in order to allow you a chance to logic out what the rules of the puzzle are, and then like increase the complexity until you're able to tackle more difficult ones, and then combining the rules of different puzzles. So for me, it's been very satisfying for a lot of it, just because of that. I actually felt like I was picking up on stuff and getting rewarded for that.
I just remembered the game that I was thinking of earlier, the sort of game to which the browser based game which sort of exposes, I suppose, the abuse of certain types of games. It was Beloved was the one I was thinking of. If you remember
that in the show notes, and me too. Did you? I don't think we heard your answer. Did you have any thoughts about player choice too?
I think, yeah, to start off, there's lots of reasons to be interested in games, both as players and as designers. And for me, it just so happens that the particular piece, the particular model of games that I'm interested in is, you know, is this idea of games as, you know, as interrogation, as I said. And that can be sort of superficial or it can be deeper. You know, and I think, you know, play as a thing, play is most interesting when it puts us at odds with ourselves. And that's something, you know, and you know, exposes, like, you know, makes us bump up against the things that we think we know about the world. And that can be something really superficial, like, you know, it can be skill level at something, or it can be, you know, the way that we think about a particular socio-political situation. And I think games that give us the room to maneuver within those spaces, you know, are just what's really interesting to me personally.
And along those same lines of player choice and like player freedom, me too, in your GDC talk, you also brought up the point that people who make games, and I'd even say that the players themselves, often believe that removing limitations from the player makes games better, even though that doesn't always work out well. Mm-hmm. Why do you think with social simulators that interactions shouldn't be totally freeform in anything and everything should be able to happen?
Right. So, you know, like I was saying, my modified version of the Sid Meier quote that games are a series of interesting gaps. You know, in order to create a gap, you still have to have the limits in place, right? You still have to have something that's bounding the sort of the player experience and the player interactions. So, yeah, you know, I think you as the designer need to have placed this particular sort of model of the world, or that's a social world or not, into your game. You know, it's not about just letting the player do anything and go anywhere. That's a sort of, you know, that doesn't make for good game design, right? Because you're not going to get gaps that way. You're just going to get this vast expanse where you're not going to come up against anything interesting.
Then why do we keep getting games that do that?
That's a good question, because, you know, I think there's this sort of false vision of games as, you know, the games being the more, you know, of games as being more interesting the more free you are as a player. But yeah, you know, I think it's just that's usually, and I think that's a result of, you know, some of the marketing language that gets used around games. And you know, famously, you know, Eric Zimmerman, etc., wrote about like the immersive fallacy, and yeah, it's all kind of wrapped up in that. So I think good design, at least the kind of design that I'm interested in, is about creating these like interesting gaps.
Jerry, do you have any opinion on limiting interactions and all that?
Yeah, I think it's very funny whenever games are made with like this incredible amount of freedom. One of the first things that people the players of those games naturally do is start creating games within the games,
yeah,
and start creating their own boundaries and like start creating and emulating other more confined or reduced experiences to then like play within these virtual worlds. So I mean, I think right there that kind of says something about the fact that people, they want those kind of boundaries in order for it to stay interesting. Because I mean, even in life, if you have just ultimate freedom, you have no obligations and nothing that you have to do, then suddenly things feel very kind of stagnant. And but if somebody leaves a mysterious post-it note on your door with a riddle on it, well, all of a sudden, like, the game's afoot. You've got a goal, you've got a mission, something to follow. And the first thing that you try to do is figure out, well, what are the rules of this? How do I think like the designer in terms of the evidence that they provided me and how that's going to guide me to the next step? And so, yeah.
So, Jerry, just because you've been working with a lot of hardware, a lot of your games, not all of them, but a lot of them have been with hardware-based games you've been making. What itch does that scratch for you as opposed to just making the software?
It's turned into a couple of things. I've kind of found myself that I'm a bit of an anxious person. I am very tactile. To the point where I've gotten in trouble at art galleries for touching things. because it is, to me, like, if an artist makes, you know, a piece with texture, then they want that sense to be appreciated.
I feel like, sorry, again, my second instance of interrupting horribly. The saddest thing, I went to an exhibit at, I think it was at the MoMA last year, where there was an exhibition of Lygia Clark's work. And, you know, and her work is all about creating things that you're supposed to touch, you're supposed to interact with. And she has these, like, awesome, I don't know how to describe them, they're these shapes, and what's intended is that you're meant to pick them up and they sort of, you know, and turn them around and put them down, and it's like, you know, they're different from kind of every angle. And of course, guess what, there was a big sign by them saying, please do not touch the exhibits. It's like,
what?
Yeah, and it's like, that's the entire purpose of that particular artist's work, like, that's kind of what she was trying to say. And yeah, so anyway, sorry, that was my
no, that's perfect. I mean, that's a perfect illustration of kind of the world that I live in and the world that I guess a lot of the art world lives in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I mean, part of it's that. Part of it's my natural inclination to be very physical with things. Part of the reason, and this was actually a huge part of how the Choosatron like became the Choosatron. After working with like mobile devices and smart devices for years, and everything's a touchscreen and everything's this faux interface, I was just sick of it. I was really, really frustrated with never getting any of that tactile feedback and like getting a feel for what I'm touching. I like driving a manual car because I like having that connection to it. I like the process. I like having my hand around it and like having that instinct of where to move it and how it works. And I hate having that barrier. So that was a huge part of it for me. And that led into like kind of going back into the different kinds of interfaces that we've created over, you know, even just like the past few decades to the last 100 years to, you know, thousands of years, and just how fascinating like the reasoning behind those things were because of limitations in technology and very specific purposes, maybe the kinds of people that were using a thing. And like that's just turned into a huge rabbit hole for me and caused a lot of my work to be going kind of further into the past and playing with those and kind of bringing those back in a new way so that people can approach this thing that feels and appears extremely alien to them. It's been scratching that itch of allowing me to be very tactile and physical, but also to remind people about a lot of those interesting stories. And I think most people miss that nowadays. They want to be able to touch things. Kids, like, they see buttons and you push the button because that's the magic of a button. You push it and something will happen. And it's really exciting to figure out what that is. I think that's a big part of that.
I mean, that's a, you know, really fascinating sort of approach to things. And I completely agree because, you know, our experience, our sort of interaction with games has always been inherently physical, right? And the fact is we don't, I guess, you know, a lot of designers, a lot of players don't think enough about that fact, about the control interface of a game as being part of the game design, as part of the thing that lets us experience a game. So my sort of PhD research was to do with sort of, you know, interfaces and how they sort of affect the way that we think about games. I did a lot of thinking about that sort of aspect of games as well, which I've yet to sort of, you know, bring across into my my commercial work, but I hope to one day.
I am always here. I would love to. Always happy to get other people.
So, Jerry, you're not going to make an iPhone game?
I didn't say that. I'm always willing to. I don't know. I made the mystery phone game, and that was I think Mitu, you had mentioned earlier working on kind of a location based game, and so that's what that was for me. It was a location based game around a city of Minneapolis specifically, and its art galleries, with a really, really, really complicated interactive fiction stories triggered at each location, with puzzles to solve. So it's like kind of text adventure with interactive fiction where you're revisiting locations in the story tree and setting variables in the background and that all collected into kind of this big finish thing. So it was on the iPhone, but it not in the, I guess, traditional sense. And at some point, like, I probably need to do some digital stuff if I want to like keep making games, and because the one-off projects aren't the most financially stable. But I wouldn't say that I have any problem with any particular like console or medium or anything like that. It's I've just been kind of having a lot of fun working with the physical and getting new people involved because it's actually become cheap enough to do it and a really viable way to create, especially with manufacturing stuff becoming easier for people, 3D printing and laser cutting, making really fast iterative design very practical. And also, like, if anything, I've been using it as a way to encourage people that are making digital experiences as a way to kind of learn more about their own games and figuring out how that kind of engagement changes an experience that does work in a purely physical way. And I've seen more and more creators making games and making alternative controllers or physical components to interact with those games specifically for going to festivals, going to conferences, even though the final version of the game that's released, is not going to have that physical component. But it's such a great way to get people engaged in the moment and very, very quickly get to kind of the best parts of that experience.
Oh, that was rad. I'm going to do one more social simulation question, and both of you can answer, but me too first. What are the most interesting social simulators out there right now, whether they're the main feature of a game or a secondary one?
I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I talked about in my GDC talk from last year was Crusader Kings 2. The reason I think that's a sort of interesting example of a game involving social simulation is that it actually, you know, the sort of social simulation components were sort of added in Crusader Kings 2, you know, which is the thing that differentiated it from the first Crusader Kings game. And they actually found that the audience became more diverse once they added this sort of social simulation component. Once it became this sort of, you know, once you could start reading it as like a sort of soap opera to do with sort of kings and country rulers and stuff. So yeah, you know, I think it's that's a really good example of the kind of thing that I've been trying to advocate for. In terms of sort of, you know, social simulations opening up games to this wider audience of people. So I think that's a really interesting example of a social simulator. Another one that I would like to plug is the next game that I'm actually working on, which is called Little Invasion Stories, which is a it's another example of a game which doesn't in which social simulation isn't the sort of primary mechanic in the game. It's like a secondary component, which hopefully will sort of create this sort of interesting aspect of the game, which I suppose just to tell you what the game is, that's probably a good place to start. Please but so Little Invasion Stories is basically this sort of mashup city builder slash sort of tower defense ish sort of game about managing, you know, about building cities, about building a city, managing these little citizens that you have who are just always sort of complaining and telling you the things that they want to see, but also trying to simultaneously defend them from the constant onslaught of alien invasion and alien abduction. So that's what the game is. It's kind of an experiment in sort of procedural storytelling in a way, because it's a game which is, what I want to do with the game is open up the sort of wonders of procedurality to like a wider, more casual audience. So, you know, it's this very cartoony, very friendly, sort of, you know, 2D game designed to sort of try to, try to be very accessible to people who don't perhaps play strategy games normally, but also have this extra component where the citizens' interaction was with each other and their environment kind of get logged and told as like a story. Wow. So yeah, and just the challenge is trying to get sort of interesting enough sort of things happening consistently, right? Which was also the sort of challenge with Red Shirt, really. And you know, and there's always the part of the challenge of trying to tell sort of that type of procedural storytelling game, like ensuring that the things that come up are consistently interesting, because so much of it is driven by player interaction and player choice, and also by the underlying computational model. So yeah, sorry, I went off on kind of a tangent there, but yeah, just encompassing all these different areas of thought.
Jerry, do you have any?
Yeah, that and that game sounds absolutely delightful. Animal Crossing.
Yes,
is a game that I have always really, really, really loved and had a lot of weird experiences with, especially when it went to the DS and you're in a much easier fashion able to connect to friends' towns and being able to move back and forth, and that allowed for like people of your town or the animals of your town to move in, move out a bit more freely. And one aspect of the game I always really enjoyed was that you could write letters to the animals. And so my friend and I, we go to a coffee shop and play this together quite often when we're talking out ideas and other projects. And especially when we first started out, we were writing all these nice letters to all these different animals, and it's very sweet, very innocent. But at some point you do kind of get tired of it because you start seeing the patterns of like, well, what do they really need in a letter in order to get a reward? And you start kind of boiling it down. And so you get lazy and may just start saying horrible things in your letters just because it's just going to a virtual animal and you don't care anymore. What really kind of backfired on us because of that, and just like writing these terrible letters to these poor virtual animals, is one day one of my friend's animals moved into my town and kind of wandered over and wanted to chat with me. So we started chatting, and then they're like, hey, you wouldn't believe the letter that Brian gave me or sent me. And I was like, what? No. And it's like, yeah, you want to read this letter? Like, I couldn't believe it. He is such a joke. Like, and this animal was mocking my friend for sending this letter. And then it showed me the letter. And
it's amazing.
Wow.
It was horrible. Like, the letter was just like, oh my God. And it felt like such an invasion of his privacy, but it also, like, it took away all those feelings I had about, like, okay, well, I've got the formula down, so, like, I'm just going through the motions. And suddenly it felt way too real. And so I immediately called him, and I was like, Brian, I read this letter of yours. I want you to know, like, if anybody comes to you with any letters of mine, just please don't read them. Just ignore it. So those kinds of experiences in Animal Crossing, I always found amazing. And I really loved the, like, in a real time mechanic of that. And it, in some senses, maybe goes a little too far in the, like, freedom of not enough to do, but I think it did a really amazing job in building this weird sense of community with all of these virtual characters, and having just enough insertion of other real people to kind of support that fantasy. And I've actually been working on an idea, and this is very much like just barely on, like, I've got a lot of the design on paper for this. But in a similar sense, not a town building, but I've been working on a concept for a flea circus game for, like, mobile or tablets, whatever, where the idea is that you, as a human, are investing money to this particular flea who wants to open a flea circus as a business, and basically generating out this growing circus town that is getting new employees and getting all these new characters, but very much with that focus of these kind of generative stories. And it's really hard to explain, because the other part of it is I've been working on how to have it still be somewhat of a physical experience.
Oh, wow.
and especially with how high resolution devices have gotten, one of the restrictions I wanted to employ is that the space you have to build your flea circus, or rather that you are empowering this kind of flea manager to build this flea circus, is limited by the exact resolution of your screen, because fleas are all one pixel or you know, extremely tiny. And so that's the space you have, and encouraging like an actual magnifying glass being used to see details of the circus that's growing over time. And I don't know how to explain much more beyond that, and it probably doesn't make any sense. But it's been very much like an experiment for me in going very much on the other side of that spectrum. So of very scripted, like interactive story tree to generative social side, the autonomous behavior model. But yeah, I don't remember the original question, but...
Well, that sounds awesome.
That game sounds so cool. And that Animal Crossing story is incredible. So, Jerry, like with the Flea Circus game, does when you're working on just software, does the work you've done with building hardware, does that inform how you're, when you are just working with software then? Like, do any, like the stuff you've been learning through making hardware help you out?
Yeah, I think so, because even when something is on a smart device... It doesn't mean that you can't use like physical space. It doesn't mean that you can't use physical objects and other components as augmentation of that experience. And I try very hard to think about it where like a smart device is much more about a tool to interact with things rather than the only window to a particular world. And in this sense, I'm actually kind of taking it very literally, where it's like, fleas are very tiny, and you have the circus that's like just literally living on the surface of your phone, and the real space of that, not something that you're zooming in and zooming out of, but like it's right there sitting on the phone, and yeah, like I said, with the trying to pull in real elements and physical things like a magnifying glass as something that actually becomes a useful tool in interacting with it. So yeah, I definitely think that that's kind of a part of it, and I think there's a lot of weird ways that you could go with that. Of you know, if you're shaking the phone, it would be a disaster for a small circus village. I assume. I haven't run the simulation yet to see just you know, because I mean, fleas are probably able to grip pretty well too, but.
You'll lose some of them.
Yeah, I mean, you'd probably, like, if you did that, you know, during, you know, when there's shows going on, when it's kind of open to the public, I assume that could, you would see a drop in ticket sales just because it's not a stable space. But, so, I've been using it as kind of a playground to think really, really weird about that sort, like, these different kind of ways to play around with that kind of virtual world, and trying not to let the idea of it being a thing I'm selling change any of that. Basically making sure to sabotage myself so that it's so bizarre that nobody would pay for it. I think that's kind of the trajectory right now.
I would totally pay for it.
Thank you.
And also, Jerry, the first game we played of yours was Afterglow at last year's GDC. And Afterglow it's a game inside of a briefcase that opens up and a visor pops out. They look through, they see like a little ring of LEDs, and your controller is a rotary telephone dial. And it's kind of like Missile Command, where you're trying to stop missiles.
Yeah.
It's really cool. But like, just, there is no, you play that game, just looking at what it is, there's like, no, there's no story to this game. You're just looking at lights. But like, if you're just looking at the whole as a whole, you can see like it's a weird, like a Cold War era story where it's like a football briefcase with nuclear launch codes that opens up and you're trying to fight off war and stuff like that. And my question is, when you're building that, are you like the story, because you're working with such simple components, are you thinking of how you're building a narrative of your game with how you're building it and what you're building it with?
Yeah. And actually, it's very much how I approach games like that, where there's very little way to tell a story. I had an entire background for that game while I was working on it. And that was kind of one of the motivations when I made like a terrible game trailer for it in an afternoon, because I was submitting it to Alt Control GDC, which kind of like it tells a little bit of what that story is. But basically, the the story that was in my head through the design of that piece was that the Soviet Union was working on this just incredible war device that would be able to protect them from attack and be this just powerful offensive weapon and make them like a true superpower, except that it's not finished until after an invasion is underway and it's too late to do anything about it. So the whole idea was there's this weird kind of casual, this apathetic attitude, especially in the trailer of like, you know what, go ahead, like see how many you can take out. It's already too late. We are all going to die. So it doesn't really matter, but go ahead, like do your best. And so, yeah, I like trying to come up with the core of those kinds of stories. And it's just a weird little background to it. But I feel like when you flesh out those worlds, even just for yourself, it's quietly transforming the way that you come up with how your game works. So it's subtly changing the decisions or molding the decisions you're making with your work. And I really like that. I like setting the stage so that like my subconscious can be like, you know, steering the ship a little bit while I'm heading toward the island in the distance, but my subconscious is moving me, you know, to and fro through the water and in a particular fashion. And so, yeah, I try to do that with a lot of the stuff I do. And it's kind of, at this point, it's kind of involuntary. I just, as soon as I have an idea, I start coming up with the history behind it and the setting and all these pointless details that no one is ever going to know about. And then, yeah, build the thing and someone plays it and they have no idea that any of that information is out there. But I still feel like it adds to the cohesiveness of it. Yeah, so it's a weird process, but it's one I particularly enjoy.
I like that idea of the subconscious co-pilot. I'm just thinking now about what you just told us about that story and how jarring. Knowing that when I was playing that game, especially when it was sitting right across from the Butt Sniffing Pugs game at DC.
Yeah. The one thing about it was I did feel very much that it was unfinished. And I've since gotten a pair of these very, very old springy metal headphones. But the thing that wasn't there that I wanted to be there was these old headphones that were playing very, very like kind of low frequency noise along with these very, very subtle signals kind of coming in from the detected chips and other stuff happening. But what I was hoping to accomplish with that, which I didn't have time to do before GDC, was to block out a lot of outside noise, but also kind of build that. Because there's this weird relationship between the separation of these ships that you're destroying, like these people that you're killing, and you're just like you're just hitting the button to do it, and this distance, and I wanted to kind of enhance the and put focus on like the eeriness of that, and yeah, it kind of the sadness of that separation, but I didn't have time, but.
As is what happens every game developer.
Yeah. It's always a work in progress.
Yeah. Me too. I want to talk about Red Shirt for a little bit.
Okay. I'm familiar with that game.
Did you explain what Red Shirt does already?
I can't remember if I did, but it's basically a social networking simulator about being this nobody on this big space station, inspired by many of our favorite space stations in certain sci-fi series, perhaps. And yeah, it's basically about being kind of, you know, at the very bottom of the sort of social and career ladders. And you're basically trying to use this, you know, social networking interface called Spacebook to try and sort of, you know, work your way up those career and social ladders. So it's a game which is basically about the ways in which we use social networks, you know, and kind of, I guess, takes a I guess it takes a sort of loving but cynical look at sort of social networking culture, and yeah, so that's the game.
What were the hardest problems you encountered making it?
Right. I mean, so I guess I alluded to this problem slightly before, but I think the hardest thing about Redshirt was trying to make sure that the player will always experience consistently interesting things, right? And I think that sort of speaks to the usual challenge, right, of a particular kind of simulation game where you can make a really interesting fishbowl, but as soon as you're trying to add sort of player agency to that, you know, like, what does that mean for the fishbowl, right? Like, what does that mean for what the game says and what it does? And yeah, because, you know, because it was a game which was very much built around these sort of autonomously behaving NPCs, I couldn't always guarantee that they were going to be interesting in any given, in any way, right? So, and I feel like there'd certainly be playthroughs or players who, you know, would have consistently interesting things always happening to them, and it was just a very dramatic playthrough, and other players might get not so interesting things happen to them. And you know, and it becomes this sort of, you almost have to, you know, then go against the autonomy behind the game and add these sort of fail safes to make sure to force certain story events, for example, in the case of nothing interesting having happened for a while, which then obviously makes it less simulation-y, for lack of a better word. But yeah, I think that's the sort of, that's the age old problem, right? With that sort of particular kind of simulation game, especially when you're trying to make interactions more specific. So, you know, in Redshirt, like, NPCs communicate with you and with each other through, you know, the usual sort of social networking types of things, like sending each other messages, posting status updates, things like that. And so, you know, it sort of loses the way that something like The Sims sort of, you know, solves that problem is by being abstract, right? Like, sort of, you know, all the interactions are very abstract, abstracted out, I should say. So, you know, you can, like, hug or kiss or tell a joke and things like that. But once you have NPCs trying to say specific things to each other, it becomes more of a challenge.
Was it harder than you expected working on all this?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was harder than I expected. I started work on it knowing that it was going to be a difficult problem. I wouldn't say I was 100% successful in solving the problem, but it definitely gave me some more interesting insight into what that would mean. And certainly, you know, I'm more cognizant of some of those things now, sort of, you know, in my future work going forward. So yeah, you know, and it was also my first commercial game. Like, I'd worked on sort of tiny, silly prototypes before, but it was like the first time I'd made a game that big. Yeah. So yeah, it was a huge learning experience for many reasons.
What don't you think you're successful with?
Well, I think, you know, that precise thing, right? Like, ensuring that consistently interesting things happen to the player. And lots of other things. I think I also fell prey to the things that many sort of, you know, many designers do in their first few games, perhaps, of just adding too many systems into the game. So, you know, both in terms of the sort of social simulation aspect. So, you know, it kind of did have the whole system soup problem, which I can never remember who it was who coined that phrase. But yeah, and also, you know, there were all these other features that I added to the game, which had nothing to do with the sort of core of the sort of social simulation storytelling aspect, which kind of just ended up being distracting. But that is why I'm also one of the things that I'm working on in addition to everything else is working on the tablet sort of re-release of the game. It's kind of like a relaunch almost for tablet, and some of those systems are kind of stripped out and the art style is very different, but it's still the sort of, you know, same game at its core, still a sort of social networking simulator set on that space station.
Have you announced a release date for that?
Not just yet, but it's going to be, I've been saying it's going to be soon for the longest time, so I've given up at this point, but we'll see how it goes.
Awesome. Also, what was your writing process like on Redshirt?
So my writing process was really, so I actually shared the writing with, I had like a freelance writer help me work on it, who was just because, you know, we needed the sheer volume of types of types of messages in the database and types of status updates was just, you know, was just huge. Because the status updates, they weren't, you know, they weren't generative, they were pre-written, but they had different attributes tagged to them. And so depending on the particular NPCs, you know, who was posting them, or, you know, or their relationship with another NPC, it would influence the game in different ways. But yeah, so I just needed help sort of building out that huge database of possible status updates. So yeah, I got a freelance writer called Lucy Hounsham to help, who is an old high school friend of mine, who is actually a big deal in the Sherlock Holmes slash fic world. She was really great at just like helping me build out that that database. And but yeah, you know, it was really the writing process was really about sitting there trying to think of as many terrible sci-fi puns as possible.
That's excellent. Jerry, I know at least with the Choose-a-tron, you wrote a bunch of the stories that were included with it. What's your writing process like?
Since most of it is, it ends up being either from straight up interactive fiction to more dynamic, but most of it on the former. I found kind of a while back that I am bad at writing linear stories. And I don't know why that is. I just get very, very frozen very, very quickly with decisions and wanting to try different things. And so interactive fiction happened to be a very natural way for me to write. And so I'll use different pieces of software, like Twine, or I've been using some of my own software that I've been developing for the Choose-a-tron, like kind of self-contained wiki pages like TiddlyWiki. And I basically just sit down and just go and go very, very nonstop for a while, creating passages after passages and very, very free form, just spilling out as much content as possible. And then occasionally like taking a step back and looking at the structure so far to see like where I want to go in terms of the balance of it and to kind of meet the overall concept I had, for it. So like some stories I'm trying to make it very, very balanced where every path is more or less the same length, giving a similar amount of content and marking things with the kind of the types of endings or types of conclusions. And then others where, like one of them where it was kind of a throwback to like how you're constantly dying in interactive fiction. And I just watched a Bond movie. So the whole story was about it being your first day on the job as a henchman for a Bond villain or a Bond-esque villain. And so for that one, I wanted there to be a really, really, really long path for the story, but I wanted every single passage of that story to have at least one way to die, so that the visually the structure is just one super long branch with all these like very, very tiny leaves off it. And then I actually, and part of looking at the structure, had given me the idea where early on I actually split it off where there's two ways to, live at a decision point where there's three choices. One of them, they each send you down a unique path that closely parallels the other one. And they both get down to the very end, except only one of them allows you to win. And so the other one, you can go through the entire story, make 20-some decisions correctly, and then get to a point where you can't win. Because it was the whole point of the story was to be very, very cruel to the player. But that's more or less my process. It's just going on a blitz of spilling stuff out, and then doing passes where I'm bouncing around and pruning the tree and moving things around a bit and editing. And but I try to get like just as much out at one time as possible.
That's a lot of similar to us. And I like your, I never thought about branching pass as like actually calling it branch with leaves on it. But switching subjects for a second, I want to hear from both of you whether VR interests you at all. But Jerry first, I wanted just to bring up that it's interesting that because we're still in early stages of VR, that there are a lot of games coming out that are fascinated with tactileness in VR space, grabbing stuff and like Keep Talking, Nobody Explodes and Job Simulator. It's especially Keep Talking. They're like, they built a contraption that could have been something you built for a real game.
Which I tried to convince them to let me. at Alt Control last year, I said, hey, if you guys ever want like to commission me to build a real physical version of this, like for fun, for promotion, whatever, I want to do it. I think I figured out how to do most of the puzzles. And I actually like put like at least a few hours into thinking about it and how I could have like the wire cutting puzzles where it dynamically changes the colors of the wires and allows you to like pull the wires apart, but not like, you know, permanently damaging them, all this kind of stuff. So I was actually very excited about the idea of building a physical version of that. But yeah, I'm extremely excited about VR. And part of that I think comes from my theater background. I love like vignettes. I love miniature like experiences, and I think VR is such a great way to do that, to create these kind of brief, wonderful, amazing encounters that like people are going to be able to communicate all sorts of ideas and in ways that would have maybe been very difficult for them to do before. And I think like there's a lot of opportunity to have those be physical experiences and to have physical components to those. While still allowing you to be very, very immersed into something. Like a really fun short experience I did at Amaze in Berlin, I think 2014, was just a guillotine simulator. So you put your head down over a basket, and like you've got the VR stuff on, and you can look around, and there's peasants yelling at you, and you can look up and see the blade and the glint of the sunlight, and then all of a sudden the blade comes down and then somebody in real life like thwacks you in the back of the neck for effect. and it was super fun. It was silly and I wouldn't say I necessarily learned anything from that, but it
I saw
was,
that. It looked incredibly mean.
Yeah, exactly. Like and like sometimes that's what I want to do as a creator. I want to play jokes on people. I want to play pranks on them and hopefully like maybe have something you know, some sort of a takeaway, something beyond that, but I think part of that attaches to that sense of play and wanting to get people excited about play and interaction and to even just stop asking the question of like what a game is and have it be much more about being open to a new experience and just kind of letting yourself being taken away by that. And VR has a lot of opportunity to do that in ways that haven't been done before, I think. So I'm super excited about it.
And me too.
Yeah, you know what? I would say broadly speaking, yes, I'm interested in VR. I was never interested in the sort of model of games which sort of prioritizes, you know, which I guess prioritizes like spatial immersion or whatever, right? So the sort of rhetoric around VR, which was all about that specifically, like, you know, whisking you away to these sort of, you know, simulated realities, etc., was never very appealing to me, which is why I'm super interested to see and very happy to see that so many people are working on these sort of weird and wonderful, quirky types of VR games, which I would have, you know, which I, you know, which I wouldn't have imagined, you know, the type of work that you've done with it, Jerry. And yeah, but with regards to the sort of, like I said, I was never very interested in that sort of model of games which buys into that rhetoric of sort of spatial immersion, but I was interested in it as a phenomenon, right? And I was interested in the fact that it's, you know, VR technology was always going to be, you know, it was going to come upon us sooner or later again. And so actually that's kind of what my PhD ended up being about. So what I was really interested in, just to sort of, I'm going to put my academic hat on now, was looking at the idea of what happens to our engagement with games as interfaces become more mimetic, right? And, you know, as our interactions with games become more mimetic, particularly with games in which you're sort of, you know, you're either controlling a third person avatar or you're in first person, right? Like where the idea is that you're playing the role of some sort of anthropomorphic character. And yeah, what I was really interested in was, you know, what happens to engagement with games, particularly when it comes to games which ask difficult things of you, like in terms of in games which are sort of, you know, morally significant in some way. So, you know, and I remember this was something I was looking at originally around the time when the sort of Call of Duty to sort of Modern Warfare 2 No Russian thing was happening. And I actually sort of built a, well, I didn't build, but I sort of, you know, just ran this study where I got people to play that scenario using like traditional controllers, like, you know, mouse and keyboard in one group and gamepad in another. And then in another group, there was like a, you know, I set it up with a Razer Hydra controller. So it was like, you know, ostensibly motion control to some like tiny greater degree. And then I just gave people like a questionnaire about like how they felt about it. Then I interviewed them and recorded them playing it. And it was really interesting because people sort of reported being a little bit more sort of troubled by the sort of motion control implementation of it. But also not really, because, you know, it was a Call of Duty game and that has a very specific context, because we sort of categorize the things we're doing in those sorts of games in a very different place. So, you know, people weren't necessarily going to think of it as sort of being morally significant, because lots of people just came to it thinking, oh, it's just a Call of Duty game, like whatever. So like towards the bigger study that I performed around all of this was making a game featuring this this rock climbing scenario, and basically the idea was, and my husband George helped me with this as well in terms of figuring out the sort of interactions, because he's worked on sort of Kinect stuff before. The idea was that it was this game about going rock climbing with this NPC partner, and you would actually sort of act out the motion of rock climbing, and then when you got to the top, there was this sort of scripted scenario where the rope would break away from the anchor, and you'd end up with your climbing partner sort of like dangling below you helplessly, and both of you sort of dangling from this one rope, which clearly wouldn't support you both. So, you know, and it ends up going into the old sort of do you cut the rope or not trope, because you're this NPC, you know, who was voiced by this very talented talented actress, was basically screaming at you and swearing to sort of just do it and just sort of cut her free, and save yourself. And so you as a player have got to make this decision about whether you, you know, physically act out the motion of sort of cutting, using the knife that appears in your hand and cutting the rope or not. And I got players to play it in three different scenarios. So one was where they were just using like a Razer Hydra for climbing, and they were just looking at like a normal monitor. In the second scenario, like different players were again using the Razer Hydra, so, you know, the motion controller for actually climbing up the rock face. But they also had head tracking as well, but they were looking at a monitor, so it was just like weird, like you'd move your head around to sort of like change the camera perspective on this monitor. And the last one was using like an Oculus Rift. And then I basically, you know, interviewed players, did like quantitative questionnaires, etc., about how they felt about the scenario and whether they felt sort of more emotionally or not about having to cut the rope when they were in this sort of VR interface. And it turned out that, yeah, you know, some people were genuinely upset by being confronted with this scenario. Especially when they were wearing like an Oculus Rift, and they took longer to decide what to do as well. Like that was like a thing that I measured, like how long it would take them to make that decision. Whereas players who were just looking at a monitor were like, yeah, okay, fine, I'm just going to do whatever you ask me to do. Going to cut you free, NPC, and let you plummet to your death. And yeah, so, you know, and that was like a really interesting result. But the more interesting part of it was when we sort of carried on the interview, and people were like really conflicted about what was happening, because they'd say things like, oh my gosh, I was so upset. Like, that was a really just upsetting scenario, but it was also just a game. But oh my gosh, I'm so upset. But I also knew it wasn't real. And, you know, and people just felt that conflict more. And I think that conflict within people, within players, is just really interesting to explore, because, you know, and I think one of the things that VR interfaces and mimetic interfaces in general have the potential to do is to, you know, obviously help us relate to what we're doing to a greater degree of granularity, right? But then we can use that potentially to trouble things more, right? Like, I don't know, can you imagine like a physical mimetic version of Papers, Please? Like, what would that mean, right? Like, if you actually had like a stamp which you had to, you know, you had to deny people access, like, what would that be? Like, that's an experiment I'd love to do. Maybe we should work together on that, Jerry. We should ask.
That would be fantastic. I was actually a friend of mine, I think it was for a game jam, had worked on a simple game. It was Lisa Brown, of a bear having to like do this paperwork and sign these documents and then like shuffle them into like this outgoing bin, and so that same kind of mechanic of going through all this physical paperwork kind of stuff.
And I'd
been talking to her. I was like, oh, I really want to make a physical version of this. Like, I kind of a digital physical hybrid. I think we could do it. So yes, definitely. I think it can be done, and I've thought about it.
Excellent.
God, that'd be so depressing too.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would love it, but oh, I feel so bad. We're gonna start winding down, but I got three more questions that we'll go through. First one is, V2, with the students you've been teaching at NYU's Game Center, have you been noticing any new trends in the games that they've been making?
Yeah, I'd say the trend is that the games they're making are just so diverse. I think that's the really cool thing. And, you know, specifically with like my specific students, you know, so I've been teaching like first year undergrads who haven't made games before. And I've been so pleasantly surprised. Like, even when I'm teaching them, like, their very first, like, introduction to programming class, right? And I was expecting, you know, and you know, having not really sort of taught in that particular context before, I was expecting, oh, yeah, you know, freshmen are going to come in and they're going to just want to make platformers. They're going to want to make just, like, you know, they're going to want to make, like, clones of existing things, but actually they're just already making these amazing expressive works. Like, you know, they're really interested in making games which say something and which like reflect some part of the world that they're interested in, and that's like so cool to me that that's happening. So yeah, I think the sort of diversity of ideas is something that I'm really that people are comfortable in making is something I'm noticing.
And Jerry, you've done teaching too a little bit, right?
I've worked with younger kids on like interactive fiction stuff, and I've just started, actually. I arrived a couple of days ago in Kentucky at Eastern Kentucky University, where I will be the visiting scholar in game design for the semester. So I'm about to.
We'll have you on again later to talk about what you've been noticing with the kids there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Okay, so the next question is, some listeners probably already know about this, but for those who don't, the game designer Chris Crawford gave a famous speech at GDC in 1992 that has been nicknamed the Dragon Speech, and it was about pursuing his dream of games as a medium of artistic expression, and to him, this dream took the shape of a dragon that needed to be slayed, which meant solving the challenges of interactive storytelling, telling truly emergent yet thoughtful and engaging stories about human beings. But Crawford felt that the industry wasn't going in that direction. So at the end of his talk, he announced his departure from the industry by charging out of the room with an actual sword in hand in the name of truth, beauty, and art. And so my question for the both of you is, where do you think we are now with slaying that dragon? Has it been done already? And can Chris Crawford finally come home?
So what was actually really cool was after the day I was giving my GDC talk about social simulation and you know, I was talking about Chris Crawford's dragon speech, I actually bumped into him in the lobby at GDC.
Oh, man.
And we ended up chatting about social simulation and then, you know, and then he whisked my husband and I off to the Redwoods basically the day after. And so we just spent a day like hanging out with Chris Crawford talking about like interactive storytelling, like in the woods and on the beach. And it was a super cool experience. But I think, you know, and that's a story for another time, but to sort of more specifically answer your question, I think, you know, I think we're sort of slowly killing the dragon with like 1,000 paper cuts, right? But we never truly will either. Like I said in my GDC talk that I think we're sort of going towards this sort of slow asymptotic victory against the dragon. Like, you know, we're never going to, you know, I don't even know if it's desirable to 100% have completely unlimited interaction with NPCs who behave 100% like other people, because I don't think that's sort of something that, I guess, even in our dealings with other people, with real other humans, like we have models for what we think they're thinking, right? Like that's kind of classic theory of mind stuff. And I think there's always some component to our interactions with games where we're going to be filling in the gaps, and we're going to be, you know, doing all these things that I referenced before. So I think in terms of, you know, telling truly completely emergent stories, I mean, yes, we're sort of, you know, we're slowly getting there, but also, you know, I don't think the end goal is, you know, completely unlimited interaction, you know, because there's always going to be things that we need to design in interesting ways. And certainly solving the tech challenges to help us get is going to sort of open up the possibilities for the types of interesting interactions that we can pursue. And certainly the sort of the other work that I'm doing, you know, in terms of the quote unquote social simulation engine stuff, is about sort of heading towards that, like using tech to help us open up the possibilities for the kinds of interesting design that's possible. But yeah, you know, I think there'll always be a place for interesting design and games with something to say.
Jerry, do you agree or disagree?
I want to believe that Chris Crawford is living in a hut in the Redwoods and has stuck his sword in the stump of a redwood tree and is like looking for someone that can pull it out. And that's why he brought you out there. I very much agree. I don't know if I could say any of that much better than you already have me to. I think we are making progress. I don't think there is a finish line. Like it just doesn't work that way. It's always going to be changing. It's always going to be growing and evolving and mutating and that's good. That's it means it's never going to get boring, and there's always going to be kind of places for us to try and, like, you know, to challenge ourselves, to challenge each other, and find out how we can do better and take it further. And things are getting easier to do that through collaboration and the ability for, like, people like us even connecting, and the education is improving and, like, you know, the kinds of things that you're able to teach your students. And, you know, suddenly, like, this entirely new group of people has now been empowered and enabled to do some incredibly new things, because they're all, you know, very unique people with unique perspectives. So yeah, definitely agree.
Good answer. I'll do the last question. Both of you, where do you see game storytelling moving in the future, and what's exciting you about the future?
It's been really exciting seeing it. Kind of a resurgence in interest in story. I don't think it was ever that nobody cared, but at least with new people coming to the industry, a lot of independents, a lot of people that have been a part of the industry for quite a while but are kind of resurfacing or coming at it from a new angle, I think there's a lot more appreciation for story, for character, for making something immersive, not through just visuals and aesthetic, but by creating a meaningful experience and communicating something, whether that's through another character or just through the game as a conduit from the game designer themselves. So that's very exciting to me, especially as someone that loves telling stories and loves finding different ways for people to engage with stories. And then also with like physical medium and how much easier that's becoming, I think there's going to be a lot of new ways, both there, both through VR and other interesting technologies, that's going to break up a lot of the homogenized types of ways that we normally interact with games. So the standard kind of controller that has these minor evolutions from console to console or keyboard and mouse, and it'll be easier for people to try things in very unique and original ways. So yeah, I think also there's going to be a point where, you know, the visual wall is going to get hit more and more, or just become more resistant. And so naturally people are going to start funneling down different paths to find ways to keep things interesting. And yeah, I'm really excited about the experimentation that's going to be possible, how much easier it's going to be to collaborate as the communities of people that are doing research and art and even people that are just purely focused on creating fun experiences, that there will be enough of those people all over the world so that people don't have to be isolated in that work. And I'm somebody that really, I do enjoy like working on things alone. I like having some of that solitude and kind of creating on my own, but even there, like it's never really on my own because I'm connecting to other people for that. But I also miss the community. And part of the way I do my work is out of necessity. Because for a long time, like, there wasn't the community I needed around me and for the stuff I wanted to do, which is thankfully changing. Even in Minneapolis, like, it's changing quite a bit and becoming more organized. So I see a bright, happy future.
What about you, Me Too?
I mean, I guess like it's that sort of continuing diversification of sort of what's possible, right? I think, like as Jerry said, you know, it's really cool to see this sort of resurgence, I suppose, of, you know, of interest in storytelling and just doing ever more interesting things with game storytelling. I think, you know, the particular piece that I'm interested in is really just like helping people understand the wonder of procedurality, right? And that's kind of part of my mission behind Little Invasion Stories, is a game all about that. Because I think, you know, I feel like we have this sort of gulf, right? In terms of sort of, I guess, systems literacy in a way. I think games have for so long told these sort of linear, sort of particularly scripted stories that if you ask somebody who, like, you know, doesn't play games about a particular game story, they're not going to necessarily understand games to be these sort of, to be anything but linear, right? Like they might talk about the particular plot of a game which doesn't actually have a plot. And I think, you know, I'm just really all about sort of getting people interested in as I said, the wonder of procedurality, the sort of tiny moments of awe that happen when we're interacting with a game and we know that something only happened for us, right? Like a particular set of events happened only in our very particular playthrough. And I think there's this kind of magic to that. And I'd love for sort of, you know, people to understand when those things happen versus when they're sort of prescripted in a way. So anyway, that's like one of the pieces of like this giant puzzle that I'm really interested in solving. But I'm also just super interested in just like, as I said, you know, this sort of diverse range of types of stories and approaches to storytelling as well that are sort of underway. And I think it's never been this sort of linear spectrum from sort of one point to another. It's about this sort of endlessly opening up just possible horizon of what games could be. And I think that's just really interesting. And I think advances in tech both in terms of, you know, trying to solve AI challenges and design challenges and hardware challenges with regards to things like VR. All of these things are helping us along the way, but they're not sort of, they're not necessarily carrying us from point A to point B. They're sort of helping us shoot off in all these different weird and wonderful directions. So that's kind of how I see it.
That's a good way to end the show, I think. Where can people find you two on the internet?
Well, you can find me on my website, jerrytron.com, J-E-R-R-Y-T-R-O-N, and get in touch with me there. My Twitter is jerrytron, but it's a 3 instead of the E because somebody's been camping on that Twitter account. And, where else? Where do people go on the internet? Is that it? That's probably most of the internet.
That's what most people say.
Yeah, that sounds like the majority of the internet being encapsulated. So, yeah, that sounds good.
And me too.
So you can find my work on thetiniestshark.com. And also I'm on Twitter at mituk, M-I-T-U-K.
And you can find this podcast at ScriptLockCast on Twitter. And with that, thank you both for coming on the show today. This is great.
Thank you so much. This has been so much
Thanks
fun.
Thanks for having us. And yeah, it was awesome getting to kind of meet you and get to know you, me too.
Likewise, Jerry. Yeah, I mean, we should definitely make that physical papers, please, together.
Yes.